tell me about it? I wasn't trying to be snarky. I was genuinely curious.
Within limits. Sam flushed.
I didn't want to press him. I could tell that Sam had already stretched those limits for me. We were each preoccupied with our own thoughts for the rest of the drive. While Eric was dead for the day, I felt alone in my skin, and usually I enjoyed that feeling. It wasn't that being bonded to Eric made me feel I was possessed or anything like that. It was more like during the dark hours, I could feel his life continuing parallel to mine. I knew he was working or arguing or content or absorbed in what he was doing. A little trickle of awareness rather than a book of knowledge.
So, the bomber yesterday, Sam said abruptly.
Yeah, I said. I think maybe a TUI of some kind, right? He nodded without looking at me.
Not a hate crime, I said, trying to sound matter-of-fact.
Not a human hate crime, Sam said, but I'm sure it's some kind of hatred.
Economic?
I can't think of any economic reason, he said. I'm insured, but I'm the only beneficiary if the bar burns down. Of course, I'd be out of business for a while, and I'm sure the other bars in the area would take up the slack, but I can't see that as an incentive. Much of an incentive, he corrected himself.
Merlot's has always been kind of a family bar, not a wild place. Not like Vic's redneck roadhouse, he added, a little bitterly.
That was true. Maybe someone doesn't like you personally, Sam, I said, though it came out sounding harsher than I'd intended. I mean, I added quickly, maybe someone wants to hurt you through damaging your business. Not you as a shapeshifter, but you as a person.
I don't recall anything that personal, he said,
genuinely bewildered. Janilyn have a vengeful ex? Anything like that? Sam was startled by the idea.
I really haven't heard of anyone who resented me dating her, he said. And Janilyn's more than capable of speaking her mind. It's not like I could coerce her into going out with me.
I had a hard time repressing a snort of laughter.
Just trying to think of all possibilities, I said apologetically.
That's okay, he said.
He shrugged.
Bottom line is, I can't remember when I've made anyone really mad.
I couldn't remember any such incident myself, and I'd known Sam for years. Pretty soon we were pulling up to the antiques shop, which was located in a former paint store in a downsliding older business street in Shreveport. The big front windows were sparkling clean, and the pieces that had been positioned there were beautiful. The largest was what my grandmother had called a hunt sideboard. It was heavy and ornate and just about as tall as my chest. The other window featured a collection of jardinières, or vases, I wasn't sure which to call them. The one in the center, positioned to show that it was the cream of the crop, was sea green and blue and had cherubs stuck on it. I thought it was hideous, but it definitely had style. Sam and I looked at the display for a moment in thoughtful silence before we went in. A bell, a real bell, not an electronic chime, jangled as we pushed open the door. A woman sitting on a stool behind a counter to the right looked up. She pushed her glasses up on her nose.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Merlot, she said, smiling with just the right intensity. I remember you. I'm glad you came back, but I'm not personally interested in you as a man.
She was good.
Thanks, Ms. Hesterman, Sam said. This is my friend, Sookie Stackhouse.
Welcome to Splendide, Ms. Hesterman said. Please call me Brenda. What can I do for you today?
We've got two errands, Sam said. I'm here to look at the pieces you called me about.
And I've just cleaned out my attic, and I have some things I wondered if you could take a look at, I said. I need to get rid of some of the odds and ends I brought down.
I don't want to put it all back.
I smiled to show general goodwill. So you've had a family place a long time? She asked, encouraging me to give her a clue about what sort of possessions my family might have accumulated.
We've lived in the same house for about 170 years, I told her, and she brightened.
but it's an old farm, not a mansion. Might be some things you'd be interested in, though.
I'd love to come take a look, she said, though clearly love was overstating it a little.
We'll set up a time as soon as I help Sam pick out a gift for Janilyn. She's so modern, who would have thought she'd be interested in antiques? She's such a little cutie.
I had a hard time keeping my mouth from dropping open. Did we know the same Janilyn Hopper?
Sam poked me in the ribs when Brenda turned her back to fetch a ring of small keys. He made a significant face, and I smoothed out my expression and batted my eyelashes at him. He looked away, but not before I caught a reluctant grin.
Sam, I've put together some things Janilyn might like, Brenda said, and led us over to a display case, keys jingling in her hand.
The case was full of little things, pretty things. I couldn't identify most of them. I leaned over the glass top to look down.
What are those?
I pointed at some lethal, sharp-pointed objects with ornate heads. I wondered if you could kill a vampire with one.
Hat pins and stick pins for scarves and cravats.
There were also earrings and rings and brooches, plus enamel boxes, beaded boxes, painted boxes. All these little containers were carefully arranged. Were they snuff boxes? I read the price tag discreetly peeking out from under a tortoiseshell and silver oval box and had to clamp my lips together to restrain my gasp.
While I was still wondering about the items I was examining, Brenda and Sam were comparing the merits of Art Deco pearl earrings versus a Victorian pressed glass hair receiver with an enameled brass lid, whatever the hell that was.
What do you think, Sookie?
He asked, looking from one item to another. I examined the Art Deco earrings, pearl drops dangling from a rose-gold setting. The hair receiver was pretty, too, though I couldn't imagine what it was for or what Janilyn would do with it. Did anyone need to receive hair anymore?
She'll wear the earrings to show them off, I said. It's harder to brag about getting a hair receiver.
Brenda gave me a veiled look, and I understood from her thoughts that this opinion branded me as a Philistine. So be it.
The hair receiver's older,
Sam said, wavering. But less personal, unless you're Victorian. While Sam compared the two smaller items to the beauties of a 70-year-old New Bedford police badge, I wandered around the store, looking at the furniture. I discovered I was not an antiques appreciator. This was just one more flaw in my mundane character, I decided. Or maybe it was because I was surrounded by antiques all the day long. Nothing in my house was new except the kitchen, and that only because the old one had been destroyed by fire. I'd still be using Gran's ancient refrigerator if the flames hadn't eaten it up. That refrigerator was one antique I didn't miss, for sure. I slid open a long, narrow drawer on what the tag described as a map chest. There was a sliver of paper left in it.
Look at that,
Brenda Hesterman's voice said from behind me.
I thought I'd gotten that thoroughly clean.
Let that be a lesson, Miss Stackhouse. Before we come to look at your things, be sure to go through them and remove all papers and other objects. You don't want to sell us something you didn't intend to part with. I turned around to see that Sam was holding a wrapped package. While I'd been lost in exploration, he'd made his purchase, the earrings to my relief. The hair receiver was back in its spot in the case.
She'll love the earrings. They're beautiful, I said honestly,
and for a second, Sam's thoughts got snarled, almost purple. Strange that I would think of colors. Lingering effect of the shaman drug I'd taken for the wares? I hope to hell not.
I'll be sure to look over everything real carefully, Brenda, I said to the antiques dealer.
We made an appointment for 2 days later. She assured me that she could find my isolated house with a GPS, and I warned her about the long driveway through the woods, which had led several visitors to believe they'd become lost.
I don't know if I'll come or my partner Donald, Brenda said. Maybe both of us.
I'll be glad to see you, I said. If you run into any trouble or need to change the date, please let me know.
Do you really think she'll like them?
Sam asked when we were in the truck and buckled up. We'd reverted to the topic of Janilyn.
Sure, I said, surprised. Why wouldn't she?
I can't shake the feeling I'm on the wrong track with Janilyn, Sam said. You want to stop and get something to eat at the Ruby Tuesdays on Uri?
Sure, I said.
Sam, why do you think that?
She likes me, he said. I mean, I can tell, but she's always thinking about the pack.
You think maybe she's more focused on Alcide than on you?
That was what I was getting from Sam's head. Maybe I was being too blunt, though. Sam flushed.
Yeah, maybe, he admitted.
She's a great enforcer, and she was real excited to get the job, I said.
I wondered if that had come out neutral enough.
She was, he said.
You seem to like strong women.
He smiled.
I do like strong women, and I'm not afraid of the different ones. Run-of-the-mill just doesn't cut it with me.
I smiled back at him.
I can tell. I don't know what to say about Janilyn, Sam. She'd be an idiot not to appreciate you. Single, self-supporting, good-looking, and you don't even pick your teeth at the table. What's not to love?
I took a deep breath because I was about to change the subject and I didn't want to offend my boss.
Hey, Sam, about that website you visit, you think you could find out about why I'm feeling more fairy after hanging out with my fairy relatives? I mean, I couldn't actually be changing into more of a fairy, right?
I'll see what I can find, Sam said after a fraught moment. But let's try asking your bunk buddies. They ought to cough up any information that would help you, or I could beat it out of them.
He was serious. They'll tell me.
I sounded more sure of that than I felt.
Where are they now? He asked.
By this time, they've gone to the club, I said after a glance at my watch. They get all their business done before the club opens.
Then that's where we'll go, Sam said. Kennedy was opening for me today, and you're not on until tonight, right?
Right, I said, discarding my plans for the afternoon, which hadn't been very urgent to start with. If we ate lunch at Ruby Tuesdays, we couldn't reach Monroe until 1:30, but I could make it home in time to change for work. After I'd ordered, I excused myself. While I was in the ladies' room, my cell phone rang. I don't answer my phone while I'm in the bathroom. I wouldn't like to be talking to someone and hear the toilet flush, right? Since the restaurant was noisy, I stepped outside to return the call after a wave at Sam. The number seemed faintly familiar.
Hey, Sookie, said Remy Savoy. How you doing?
Good. How's my favorite little boy?
Remy had been married to my cousin Hadley, and they'd had a son, Hunter, who would be starting kindergarten in the fall. After Katrina, Remy and Hunter had moved to the little town of Red Ditch, where Remy had gotten a job working at a lumber yard through the good services of a cousin.
He's doing good. He's trying hard to follow your rules. I wonder if I could ask a favor?
Let's hear it, I said.
I've started dating a lady here named Aaron. We were thinking about going to the bass fishing tournament outside Baton Rouge this weekend. We were kind of hoping you could keep Hunter. He gets bored if I fish more than an hour.
Remy moved pretty fast. Kristen hadn't been too long ago, and she'd already been replaced. I could kind of see it. Remy wasn't bad-looking, he was a skilled carpenter, and he had only one child. Plus, Hunter's mom was dead, so there weren't any custody issues. Not too shabby a prospect in the town of Red Ditch.
Remy, I'm on the road right now, I said. Let me call you back in a little while. I gotta check my work schedule.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sookie. Talk to you later.
I went back inside to find that our food had been served.
That was Hunter's dad calling, I told my boss after the server left. Remy's got a new girlfriend, and he wanted to know if I could keep Hunter this weekend. I got the impression that Sam believed Remy was trying to take advantage of me, but Sam also felt he could hardly tell me what to do about it.
If I remember the schedule right, you're working this Saturday night,
he pointed out. And Saturday night was when I made my biggest tips. I nodded, both to Sam and myself. While we ate, We talked about Terry's negotiations with a breeder of Catahoulas in Ruston. Terry's Annie had gotten out of her pen last time she'd been in heat. This time, Terry had a more planned pregnancy in mind, and the talks between the two men had nearly reached prenup status. A question rose to my mind, and I wasn't quite sure how to phrase it to Sam. My curiosity got the better of me. "You remember Bob the Cat?" I asked.
"Sure. That guy Amelia turned into a cat by accident. Her friend Octavia turned him back."
"Yeah. Well, the thing is, while he was a cat, he was black and white. He was a really cute cat. But Amelia found a female cat in the woods with a litter, and there were some black and white kittens among them, so she got... Okay, I know this is weird. She got pissed off at Bob because she thought he'd, you know, become a dad? Sort of?"
"So your question is that a common thing?" Sam looked disgusted.
"Nah, Sookie. We can't do that, and we don't want to. None of the two-natured. Even if there were a sexual encounter, there wouldn't be a pregnancy. I think Amelia was accusing Bob falsely. On the other hand, he wasn't really two-natured. He was completely transformed by magic."
Sam shrugged. He looked very embarrassed. "Sorry," I said, feeling mortified. "That was tacky of me."
"It's a natural thing to wonder about, I guess," Sam said dubiously. "But when I'm in my other skin, I'm not out making puppies."
Now I was horribly embarrassed. "Please, accept my apology," I said. He relaxed when he saw how uncomfortable I was. He patted me on the shoulder.
"Don't worry about it."
Then he asked me what plans I had for the attic now that I'd emptied it, and we talked of trivial things until we were back to feeling okay with each other. I called Remy back when we were on the interstate. "Remy, this weekend won't work for me. Sorry." I explained that I had to work.
"Don't worry about it," Remy said. He sounded calm about my refusal. "It was just a thought. Listen, here's the thing. I hate to ask for another favor, but Hunter has to visit the kindergarten next week. Just a thing the school does every year so the kids will have a mental picture of the place they're going in the fall. They tour the classrooms, meet the teachers, and see the lunchroom and the bathrooms. Hunter asked me if you could go with us."
My mouth fell open. I was glad Remy couldn't see me. "This is during the day, I'm assuming," I said. "What day of the week?"
"Next Tuesday, 2:00.
Unless I was on for the lunch shift, I could do it. Again, let me check my work schedule, but I think that's going to be doable," I said. "I'll call you back tonight." I snapped my phone shut and told Sam about Remy's second request.
"Seems like he waited to ask you the more important thing second, so you'd be more likely to come," Sam said. I laughed.
"I didn't think of that until you said it. My brain is wired in a straighter line than that. But now that it's crossed my mind, that seems not unlikely." I shrugged. "It's not like I object, exactly. I want Hunter to be happy. And I've spent time with him, though not as much as I should have." Hunter and I were alike in a hidden way. We were both telepathic. But that was our secret because I feared Hunter might be in danger if his ability was known. It sure hadn't improved my life any.
"So why are you worried? Because I can tell you are,"
Sam said. "Just, it'll look funny. People in Red Ditch will think Remy and I are dating, that I'm sort of close to being Hunter's mom. And Remy just told me he's seeing a woman named Erin, and she may not like it." My voice trailed off. This visit seemed like a mildly bad idea, but if it would make Hunter happy, I supposed I ought to do it.
"You have that sucked-in feeling?"
Sam's smile was wry. It was our day to talk about awkward things. "Yeah," I admitted. "I do. When I got involved in Hunter's life, I didn't ever imagine he'd really depend on me for anything. I guess I've never been around kids that much. Remy's got a great aunt and great uncle in Red Ditch, That's why he moved there after Katrina. They had an empty rental house. But the aunt and uncle are too old to want to keep a kid Hunter's age for more than an hour or two, and the one cousin is too busy to be much help.
Hunter a good kid?
Yes, I think he is. I smiled. You know, it's weird. When Hunter stayed with me, he and Claude got along great. That was a big surprise. Sam glanced over at me.
But you wouldn't want to leave him with Claude for hours, would you?
After a moment's thought, I said, no. Sam nodded, as if I'd confirmed something that he'd been wondering about.
'Cause after all, Claude's a fairy.
He put enough question into his voice to ensure that I knew he was genuinely asking me. The words sounded very unpleasant said out loud, but they were the truth. Yes, because Claude's a fairy, but not because he's a different race from us. I struggled with how to express what I wanted to say. Fairies, they love kids, but they don't have the same frame of reference as most humans. Fairies will do what they think will make the child happy or will benefit the child rather than what a Christian adult would do. It made me feel small and provincial to admit all this, but those were my true feelings. I felt like adding a series of disclaimers. Not that I think I'm such a great Christian, far from it. Not that non-Christians are bad people. Not that I think Claude would hurt Hunter. But Sam and I had known each other long enough that I was sure he'd understand all that.
I'm glad we're on the same page, Sam said, and I felt relieved. But I was far from comfortable.
We might be on the same page, but I wasn't happy about reading it. Spring was verging on summer, and the day was beautiful. I tried to enjoy it all the way east to Monroe, but my success was limited. My cousin Claude owned Hooligans, a strip club off the interstate outside Monroe. On five nights a week, it featured the conventional entertainment offered at strip clubs. The club was closed on Mondays, but Thursday night was ladies only, and that was when Claude stripped. Of course, he wasn't the only male who performed. At least three other male strippers came in on a rotating basis pretty regularly, and there was usually a guest stripper, too. There was a male strip circuit, my cousin had told me.
You ever come here to watch him?
Sam asked as we pulled up to the back door. He was not the first person to ask me that. I was beginning to think there was something wrong with me, that I hadn't felt the need to rush over to Monroe to watch guys take off their clothes. No. I've seen Claude naked. I've never come over to watch him do his thing professionally. I hear he's good.
He's naked? At your house?
Modesty is not one of Claude's priorities, I said. Sam looked both displeased and startled, despite his own earlier warning about the Fae not thinking kin were off-limits sexually.
What about Dermot? He said.
Dermot? I don't think he strips, I said, confused.
I mean, he doesn't go around the house naked, does he?
No, I said. That seems to be a Claude thing. It would be really icky if Dermot did that, since he looks so much like Jason.
That's just not right, Sam muttered. Claude needs to keep his pants on.
I dealt with it, I said, the edge in my voice reminding Sam that the situation was not his to worry about. It was a weekday, so the place didn't open until 4 in the afternoon. I had never been to Hooligans before, but it looked like any other small club, set apart in a fair-sized parking lot, electric blue siding, a jazzy, shocking pink sign. Places for selling alcohol or flesh always look a little sad in the daytime, don't they? The only other business close to Hooligans, now that I was looking, was a liquor store. Claude had told me what to do in case I ever dropped in. The secret signal was knocking 4 times, keeping the raps evenly spaced. After that was done, I gazed out across the fields. The sun beat down on the parking lot with just a hint of the heat to come. Sam shifted uneasily from foot to foot. After a few seconds, the door opened. I smiled and said hello automatically and began to step into the hall. It was a shock to realize the doorman wasn't human. I froze. I'd assumed that Claude and Dermot were the only fairies left in modern-day America since my great-grandfather had pulled all the fairies into their own dimension, or world, or whatever they called it, and closed the door. Though I'd also known that Niall and Claude communicated at least occasionally, because Niall had sent me a letter via Claude's hands. But I deliberately refrained from asking a lot of questions. My experiences with my fairy kin, with all the fae, had been both delightful and horrible. But toward the end, those experiences had come down far heavier on the horrible side of the scale. The doorman was just as startled to see me as I was to see him. He wasn't a fairy, but he was fae. I'd met fairies who'd filed their teeth to look the way this creature's did naturally, an inch long, pointed, curved slightly inward. The doorman's ears weren't pointed, but I didn't think it was surgical alteration that had made them flatter and rounder than human ears. The alien effect was lessened by his thick, fine hair, which was a rich auburn color and lay smooth, about 3 inches long, all over his head. The effect was not that of a hairstyle, but of an animal's coat. "What are you?" we asked each other simultaneously. It would have been funny in another universe.
"What's happening?"
Sam said behind me, and I jumped. I stepped all the way inside the club with Sam right on my heels, and the heavy metal door clanged shut behind us. After the dazzling sunlight, the long fluorescent bulbs that lit the hall looked doubly bleak.
"I'm Sookie," I said, to break the awkward silence.
"What are you?"
the creature asked again. We were still standing awkwardly in the narrow hallway. Dermot's head popped out of a doorway.
"Hey, Sookie," he said. "I see you've met Belenos."
He stepped out into the hall and took in my expression.
"Haven't you ever seen an elf before?"
"I haven't, thanks for asking," muttered Sam. Since he was much more knowledgeable about the soup world than I was, I realized that elves must be pretty rare. I had a lot of questions about Belenos' presence, but I wasn't sure if I had any right to ask them, especially after my faux pas with Sam.
"Sorry, Belenos. I did meet a half-elf once with teeth like yours. Mostly, though, I know fairies who file their teeth to look that way. Pleased to meet you," I said with a huge effort. "This is my friend Sam."
Sam shook hands with Belenos. The two were much the same height and build, but I noticed that Belenos's slanted eyes were dark brown, matching the freckles on his milky skin. Those eyes were curiously far apart, or perhaps his face was broader across the cheekbones than normal. The elf smiled at Sam, and I caught a glimpse of the teeth again. I shuddered and looked away. Through an open door, I glimpsed a large dressing room. There was a long counter running along one wall, which was lined with a brightly lit mirror. The counter was strewn with cosmetics, makeup brushes, blow dryers, hair curlers and hair straighteners, bits of costume, razors, a magazine or two, wigs, cell phones, the assorted debris of people whose jobs depended on their appearance. Some high stools were set haphazardly around the room, and there were tote bags and shoes everywhere. From farther down the hall, Dermot called,
"Come into the office."
We went down the hall and crowded into a small room. Somewhat to my disappointment, the exotic and gorgeous Claude had a completely prosaic office, cramped, cluttered, and windowless. Claude had a secretary, a woman dressed in a JCPenney women's business suit. She could not have looked more incongruous in a strip club. Dermot, who was evidently the master of ceremonies today, said,
"Nella Jean, this is our dear cousin Sookie."
Nella Jean was dark and round, and her bitter chocolate eyes were almost a match for Belenos's, though her teeth were reassuringly normal. Her little cubbyhole was right next door to Claude's office. In fact, I conjectured that it had been converted from a storage closet. After a disparaging look at Sam and me, Nella Jean seemed more than ready to retreat to her own space. She shut her office door with an air of finality, as if she knew we were going to do something unsavory and she wanted nothing to do with us. Belenos shut Claude's office door, too, closing us in a room that would have been crowded with two of us, much less five. I could hear music coming from the club proper, or rather the club improper, and I wondered what was happening out there. Did strippers rehearse? What did they make of Bellanos?
Why the surprise visit? Claude asked. Not that I'm not delighted to see you.
He wasn't delighted to see me at all, though he'd invited me to drop by Hooligans more than once. It was clear from his sulky mouth that he'd never believed I'd come to see him at the club unless he was on stage stripping. Of course, Claude's sure everyone in the world wants to see him take off his clothes, I thought. Did he just not enjoy visitors? Or was there something he didn't want me to know?
You need to tell us why Sookie's feeling more and more fey, Sam said abruptly.
The three fey males turned to look at Sam simultaneously. Claude said,
Why do we need to tell her that? And why are you concerning yourself with our family affairs?
Because Sookie wants to know why and she's my friend, Sam said.
His face was hard, his voice very level.
You should be educating her about her mixed blood instead of living in her house and leeching off her.
I didn't know where to look. I hadn't known Sam was so opposed to my cousin and my great uncle staying with me, and he really didn't need to give his opinion. And Claude and Dermot weren't leeching off me. They bought groceries, too, and they cleaned up after themselves very carefully. Sometimes. It was true that my water bill had jumped, and I had said something to Claude about that, but nothing else had cost me money.
In fact,
Sam said when they continued to glare at him in silence,
you're staying with her to make sure she'll be more fey, right? You're encouraging that part of her to strengthen. I don't know how you're doing that, but I know you are. My question is, are you doing this just for the warmth of it, the companionship, or do you have a plan in mind for Sookie? Some kind of secret fairy plot?
The last words were more like an ominous rumble than Sam's normal voice. Claude's my cousin and Dermot's my great uncle, I said automatically. They wouldn't try to... And I let the thought trail off dismally. If I'd learned anything over the past few years, it was not to make stupid assumptions. The idea that family would not harm you was a stupid assumption of the first order.
Come see the rest of the club, Claude said suddenly.
Before we could think about it, he'd hustled us out of the office and down the hall. He swung open the door to the club proper, and Sam and I went into it. I guess all clubs and bars look basically the same. Tables and chairs, some attempt at decor or theme, an actual bar, a stage with stripper poles, and some kind of booth for sound. In those respects, Hooligans was no different. But all the creatures that turned to the door when we entered, all of them were fey. It came to me slowly and inevitably as I looked from face to face. No matter how human they looked, and most of them could pass, each one had a trace of fey blood of one kind or another. A beautiful female with flame-red hair was part elf. She'd had her teeth filed down. A long, slim male was something I'd never encountered before.
Welcome, sister,
said a short, blonde, something. I couldn't even be sure of the gender.
Have you come to join us here?
I struggled to answer. I hadn't planned on it, I said. I stepped back into the hall and let the door shut after me. I gripped Claude's arm.
What the hell is going on here?
When he didn't answer, I turned to my great uncle.
Dermot?
Sookie, our dearest,
Dermot said after a moment's silence.
Tonight, when we come home, we'll tell you everything you need to know.
What about him?
I said, nodding at Bellanos.
He won't be with us, Claude said. Bellanos sleeps here as our night watchman.
You only needed a night watchman if you were afraid of an attack.
More trouble. I could hardly stand the prospect of it.
Chapter 3 Okay, I've been stupid in the past.
Not consistently stupid, but occasionally stupid. And I've made mistakes. You bet I've made mistakes. But during the ride back to Bon Ton, with my best guy friend driving and giving me the silence I needed, I thought hard. I felt a tear trickle from each eye. I looked away and blotted my face with a tissue from my purse, not wanting Sam to offer sympathy. When I'd composed myself, I said, "I've been a fool." To his credit, Sam looked startled.
"What are you thinking of?"
he said, so he wouldn't say which time.
"Do you think people really change, Sam?"
He took a moment to line up his thoughts.
"That's a pretty big question, Sookie. People can turn themselves around to some extent, sure. Addicts can be strong enough to stop using whatever they're addicted to. People can go to therapy and learn how to manage behavior that's been out of control. But that's an external system, a learned management technique imposed on the natural order of things, on what the person really is, an addict. Does that make sense?"
I nodded.
"So, on the whole," he continued, "I'd have to say no. People don't change, but they can learn to behave differently. I want to believe otherwise. If you have an argument that says I'm wrong, I'd be glad to hear it."
We turned down my driveway and began to go through the woods.
"Children change as they grow up and adapt to society and their own circumstances," I said. "Sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad. And I think if you love someone, you make an effort to suppress habits of yours that displease them, right? But those habits or inclinations are still there."
"Sam, you're right. Those are other cases of people imposing a learned reaction over the original." He gave me worried eyes as we pulled up behind the house.
"Sookie, what's wrong?"
I shook my head.
"I'm such an idiot," I told him.
I couldn't look him square in the face. I scrambled out of the truck.
"Are you taking the whole day off, or will I see you at the bar later?"
"I'm taking the whole day off.
Listen, do you need me to stick around?
I'm not real sure what you're worried about, but you know we can talk about it. I have no idea what is going on at Hooligan's, but until the fairies feel like telling us, I'm here if you need me."
He was sincere in his offer. But I also knew he wanted to get home, call Janilyn, make plans for the night so he could give her the gift he'd gone to such trouble to select.
"No, I'm good,"
I said reassuringly, smiling up at him. "I've got a million things to do before I come to work, and a lot to think about, to put it mildly."
"Thanks for going to Shreveport with me, Sookie," Sam said, "but I guess I was wrong about getting your kinfolk to talk to you. Let me know if they don't come through tonight."
I waved goodbye as he backed up to drive back to Hummingbird Road to return to his double wide, situated right behind Merlot's. Sam never completely got away from work, but on the other hand, it was a real short commute. As I unlocked the back door, I was already making plans. I felt like having a shower. No, a bath. It was actually delightful to be alone, to have Claude and Dermot out of the house. I was full of new suspicion, but that was a sadly familiar feeling. I thought about calling Amelia, my witch friend who had returned to New Orleans to her rebuilt home and her reestablished job, to ask her advice about several things. In the end, I didn't pick up the phone. I would have to explain so much. The prospect made my brain feel tired, and that was no way to start a conversation. An email might be better. I could set everything down that way. I filled the tub with bath oils, and I climbed into the hot water in a gingerly way, baring my teeth as I sank down. The front of my thighs still stung a bit. I shaved my legs and underarms. Grooming always makes you feel better. After I'd climbed out, the bath oil making me as slippery as a wrestler, I painted my toenails and brushed out my hair, startled all over again by how short it seemed. It was still past my shoulder blades, I reassured myself. All buffed and polished, I put on my Merlot's outfit, sorry to cover up my toenails with socks and sneakers.
I was trying not to think, and I was doing a pretty good job of it. I had about 30 minutes to spare, so I turned on the TV and clicked on my DVR button to view yesterday's Jeopardy. We'd started turning the bar TV to it every day because the bar patrons got some enjoyment out of guessing the answers. Jane Bodehouse, our longest-lasting alcoholic, turned out to be an expert on old movies, and Terry Belfleur surely knew his sports trivia. I could answer most of the questions about writers since I read a lot, and Sam was pretty reliable on American history after 1900. I wasn't always at the bar when it was on, so I'd started recording it every day. I liked the happy world of Jeopardy. I liked getting the Daily Double, which I did today. When the show was finished, it was time to leave. I enjoyed driving to work for the evening shift when it was still light outside. I turned up the radio and sang Crazy right along with Gnarls Barkley. I could identify. Jason passed me driving in the opposite direction, maybe on his way to his girlfriend's house. Michelle Schubert was still hanging in the relationship. Since Jason was finally growing up, she might make something permanent with him, if she wanted to. Michelle's strongest suit was that she wasn't enthralled by Jason's, apparently, powerful bedroom mojo. If she was mooning over him and jealous of his attention, she was keeping it perfectly concealed. My hat was off to her. I waved at my brother and he smiled back. He looked happy and unconflicted. I envied that from the bottom of my heart. There were big pluses to the way Jason approached life. The crowd at Merlot's was thin again. No surprise there. A firebombing is pretty bad publicity. What if Merlot's couldn't survive? What if Vic's Redneck Roadhouse kept stealing customers? People liked Merlot's because it was relatively quiet, because it was relaxed, because the food was good, if limited, and the drinks were generous. Sam had always been a popular guy until the were-animals had made their own announcement. People who had handled the vampires with cautious acceptance seemed to regard Tui's as the straws that had broken the camel's back, so to speak. I went into the storeroom to grab a clean apron and then into Sam's office to stuff my purse into the deep drawer of his desk. It sure would be nice to have a little locker. I could keep my purse in it and a change of clothes for nights when minor disasters struck, like spilled beer or a squirt of mustard. I was taken over from Holly, who would marry Jason's best friend, Hoyt, in October. This would be Holly's second wedding, Hoyt's first. They decided to go all out and have a church ceremony and a reception in the church hall afterward. I knew more about it than I wanted to know. Though the wedding wasn't for months, Holly had already begun obsessing about details. Since her first wedding had been a Justice of the Peace visit, this was, theoretically, her last chance to live the dream. I could imagine my grandmother's opinion about Holly's white wedding dress, since Holly had a little boy in school, but hey, whatever made the bride happy. White used to symbolize the virgin purity of the wearer. Now it just meant the bride had acquired an expensive and unusable dress to hang in her closet after the big day. I waved at Holly to attract her attention. She was talking to the new Calgary Baptist preacher, Brother Collins. He came in from time to time, but never ordered alcohol. Holly ended her conversation and strode over to tell me what was happening at our tables, which wasn't much. I shuddered when I looked at the scorched mark in the middle of the floor. One less table to serve.
"Hey, Sookie," Holly said, pausing on her way to the back to fetch her purse.
"You'll be at the wedding, right?"
"Sure, wouldn't miss it."
"Would you mind serving the punch?" This was an honor, not as big an honor as being a bridesmaid, but still significant. I'd never expected such a thing.
"I'd be glad to,"
I said, smiling.
"Let's talk again closer to time."
Holly looked pleased.
"Okay, good.
Well, let's hope business picks up here so we still have a job come September."
"Oh, you know we'll be okay,"
I said, but I was far from convinced that was so. I stayed up waiting for Dermot and Claude for half an hour after I got home that night, but they didn't show, and I didn't feel like calling them. Their promised talk with me, the talk that was supposed to fill me in on my fairy heritage, would not take place tonight. Though I'd wanted to hear some answers, I found I was just as glad.
The day had been too full. I told myself I was pissed off, and I tried to listen for the fairies to come in, but I didn't lie awake more than 5 minutes. When I emerged the next morning, a little after 9, I didn't see any of the usual signs that indicated my house guests had returned. The hall bathroom looked exactly as it had the day before. There weren't any dishes by the kitchen sink, and none of the lights had been left on. I went out on the enclosed back porch. Nope, no car. Maybe they'd been too tired to make the drive back to Bon Ton, or maybe they'd both gotten lucky. When Claude had come to live with me, he told me that if he made a conquest, he'd spend the night at his house in Monroe with a lucky guy. I had assumed Dermot would do the same, though, come to think of it, I'd never seen Dermot with anyone, man or woman. I'd also assumed that Dermot would choose women over men simply because he looked like Jason, who was all about the ladies. Assumptions. Dumb. I fixed myself some eggs and toast and fruit and read a library copy of one of Nora Roberts's books while I ate. I felt more like my former self than I had in weeks. Except for the visit to Hooligans, I'd had a nice time the day before, and the guys weren't trailing in and out of the kitchen, complaining about me being low on whole wheat bread or hot water, Claude, or offering me flowery pleasantries when all I wanted to do was read, Dermot. Nice to discover that I could still enjoy being alone. Singing to myself, I showered and made myself up, and by that time I had to leave for work again for the early shift. I glanced into the living room, tired of it looking like a junk store. I reminded myself that tomorrow the antiques dealers were supposed to come. The bar was a little busier than it had been the night before, which made me even more cheerful. A little to my surprise, Kennedy was behind the bar. She looked as polished and perfect as the beauty queen she'd been, though she was wearing tight jeans and a white and gray striped tank. We were quite the well-groomed women today. "Where's Sam?" I asked. "I thought he would be working." "He called me this morning, said he was still over in Shreveport," Kennedy said, giving me a sideways look. I guess Janilyn's birthday went real well. I need as many hours as I can get, so I was glad to roll out of bed and get my honey over here. "How's your mama and your daddy?" I asked. "Have they visited lately?" Kennedy smiled bitterly. "They're just rolling along, Sookie. They still wish I was Little Miss Beauty Pageant and taught Sunday school, but they did send me a good check when I got out of prison. I'm lucky to have them." Her hands stilled in the middle of drying a glass. "I've been wondering," she said, and paused. I waited. I knew what was coming. "I was wondering if it was a member of Casey's family who bombed the bar," she said, very quietly. "When I shot Casey, I was just saving my own life. I didn't think about his family or my family or anything but living." Kennedy had never talked about it before, which I could understand completely. "Who would be thinking about anything else but surviving, Kennedy?" I said, quietly but with intensity. I wanted her to feel my absolute sincerity. "No one in her right mind would have done any different. I don't think God would ever want you to let yourself be beaten to death." Though I was not at all sure what God would want. I probably meant, I think it would have been dumb as hell to let yourself be killed.
"I wouldn't have gotten off so light if those other women hadn't come forward," Kennedy said. "His family, I guess they know he really did hit women, but I wonder if they still blame me. If maybe they knew I'd be in the bar and they decided to kill me here."
"Are any of his family two-natured?" I asked. Kennedy looked shocked.
"Oh my gosh, no! They're Baptists!"
I tried not to smile, but I couldn't help it. After a second, Kennedy started laughing at herself.
"Seriously," she said, "I don't think so. You think whoever threw that bomb was aware?"
"Or some other kind of two-natured. Yeah, I think so, but don't tell us around anywhere. Sam's already feeling the backlash enough as it is." Kennedy nodded in complete agreement. A customer called to me to bring him a bottle of hot sauce, and I had new food for thought. The server replacing me called in to say her car had a flat tire, and I stayed at Merlot's 2 extra hours. Kennedy, who'd be there until closing, gave me a hard time about being indispensable until I swatted her with a towel. Kennedy perked up quite a bit when Danny came in. He'd obviously gone home after work to shower and shave again, and he looked at Kennedy as if his world were now complete when he climbed onto the bar stool. What he said was,
"Give me a beer and be quick about it, woman."
"You want me to pour that beer on your head, Danny?"
"Don't make no difference to me how I get it."
And they grinned at each other. Just after dark, my cell phone vibrated in my apron pocket. As soon as I could, I stepped into Sam's office. I'd gotten a text from Eric.
"See you later," it said.
And that was all. But I had a genuine smile on my face the rest of the evening, and when I drove home, I felt happy all over to see Eric sitting on my front porch, whether he'd wrecked my kitchen or not. And he had a new toaster with him, a red bow stuck to the box. "To what do I owe the honor?" I asked tartly. It didn't do to let Eric know I'd been anticipating his visit. Of course, he probably had an idea that was so through our blood bond.
"We haven't had any fun lately," he said.
He handed over the toaster. "Between me putting out a fire and you attacking Pam, yeah, I'd say that was a fair statement. Thanks for the replacement toaster, though I wouldn't classify that as fun."
"What do you have in mind?"
"Later, of course. I have spectacular sex in mind,"
he said, standing up and walking over to me.
"I've thought of a position we haven't tried yet."
I'm not as flexible as Eric, and the last time we tried something real adventurous, I'd had a sore hip for 3 days, but I was willing to experiment.
"What do you have in mind before the spectacular sex?" I asked.
"We have to visit a new dance club," he said. But I caught the shade of worry in his voice. "That's what they're calling it, to try to bring in the young people who look pretty, like you."
"Where is this dance club?" Since I'd been on my feet for hours, this plan was not the most tempting, but it had been a long time since we'd had fun as a couple, in public.
"It's between here and Shreveport," Eric said, and hesitated. "Victor just opened it."
"Oh. Is it smart for you to go there?" I said, dismayed. Eric's program had zero appeal now. Victor and Eric were engaged in a silent struggle. Victor Madden was the Louisiana proxy for Felipe, king of Nevada, Arkansas, and Louisiana. Felipe was based in Las Vegas, and we wondered, Eric and Pam and I, if he'd given Victor this large bone simply to get the ambitious Victor out of Felipe's richest territory. In my heart of hearts, I wanted Victor to die. Victor had sent his 2 most trusted minions, Bruno and Corinna, to kill Pam and me, simply in order to weaken Eric, whom Felipe had retained since he was the most productive sheriff in the state. Pam and I had turned the tables. Bruno and Corinna were piles of dust by the interstate, and no one could prove we'd done it. Victor had put out the word that he was offering a high bounty for anyone who could give him some information on his minions' whereabouts, but no one had come forward. Only Pam, Eric, and I knew what had happened. Victor could hardly accuse us outright, since that would be admitting that he'd sent them to kill us. Kind of a Mexican standoff. Next time, Victor might send someone more cautious and careful. Bruno and Corinna had been overconfident.
"It's not smart to go to this club, but we don't have a choice,"
Eric said.
"Victor has ordered me to make an appearance with my wife. He'll think I'm afraid of him if I don't bring you."
I thought this through while I was searching my closet, trying to think of anything I owned that would look good at a trendy dance club. Eric was lying on my bed, his hands behind his head.
"There's something in my car, I forgot,"
he said suddenly, and was a blur going out the door. He was back in seconds, carrying a garment on a hanger enveloped in a clear plastic bag.
"What?"
I said. "It's not my birthday."
"Can't a vampire give his lover a present?"
I had to smile back at him.
Well, yes, he can,
I said. I love presents. The toaster had been reparation. This was a surprise. I carefully removed the plastic bag. The garment on the hanger was a dress. Probably.
Is this the whole thing?
I asked, holding it up. There was a black U-shaped neckband, a large U both front and back, and the rest was bronze and shiny and pleated, like many broad bronze ribbons sewn together.
Well, not so many.
The saleswoman had left the price tag on. I tried not to look, failed, and felt my mouth fall open after I'd absorbed it.
I could buy 6 or maybe 10 pieces at Walmart or 3 at Dillard's for the price of this dress.
You will look wonderful,
Eric said. He grinned fangily.
Everyone will envy me.
Who wouldn't feel good hearing that? I emerged from the bathroom to find that my new buddy Emmanuel was back. He'd set up a hair and makeup station on my dressing table. It felt very odd to see yet another man in my bedroom. Emmanuel seemed to be in a much happier mood tonight. Even his odd haircut looked perkier. While Eric watched as closely as if he suspected Emmanuel of being an assassin, the skinny hairdresser poofed me and curled me and made me up. Since Tara and I had been little girls, I hadn't had such a fun time in front of a mirror. When Emmanuel was through, I looked glossy and confident.
Thank you,
I said, wondering where the real Sookie had gone.
You're welcome,
Emmanuel said seriously.
You've got great skin. I like working on you.
No one had ever said that to me, and all I could come up with in response was,
please leave a card.
He fished one out and propped it against a China lady my grandmother had loved. The juxtaposition left me feeling a little sad. I'd come down a long road since her death.
How's your sister?
I asked, since I was thinking of sad things.
She had a good day today, Emmanuel said. Thanks for asking.
Though he didn't look at Eric while he said this, I saw Eric glance away, his jaw tight, irritated. Emmanuel departed after packing up all his paraphernalia, and I found a strapless bra and a thong, which I hated, but who wants a panty line under a dress like that, and began to assemble myself. Luckily, I had good black heels. I knew strappy sandals would suit the dress better, but the heels would have to do. Eric had really paid attention as I got dressed.
So smooth,
he said, running his hand up my leg.
Hey, you keep doing that. We won't get to the club, and all this preparation will have gone to waste.
Call me pathetic, but I actually did want someone else besides Eric to see the total effect of the new dress and the new hair and the good makeup.
Not entirely to waste,
he said. But he changed into his own party clothes. I braided his hair so it would look neat and tied the end with a black ribbon. Eric looked like a buccaneer out on the town. We should have been happy, excited about our date, looking forward to dancing together at the club. I couldn't know what Eric was thinking as we walked out to his car, but I knew he wasn't happy with what we were doing and where we were going. That made two of us. I decided to ease into a back and forth with a little light conversation.
How are the new vamps working out?
I said.
They come in when they're supposed to and put in their bar time,
he said unenthusiastically. 3 vampires who'd ended up in Eric's area after Katrina had asked Eric for permission to stay in Area 5, though they wanted to nest in Minden, not Shreveport itself.
What's wrong with them?
I said. You don't seem very excited about the addition to your ranks. I slid into my seat. Eric walked around the car.
Palomino does well enough,
he admitted grudgingly as he got in on the driver's side.
But Rubio is stupid, and Parker is weak.
I didn't know the 3 well enough to debate that. Palomino, who went by one name, was an attractive young vampire with freaky coloring. Her skin was a natural tan tone, while her hair was pale blonde. Rubio Hermosa was handsome, but I had to agree with Eric.
He was dim and never had much to say for himself. Parker was as nerdy in death as he had been in life, and though he'd improved the Fantasia computer systems, he seemed scared of his own shadow.
"You want to talk to me about the argument between you and Pam?" I asked once I'd buckled up. Instead of his Corvette, Eric had brought Fantasia's Lincoln Town Car. It was incredibly comfortable, and given the way he drove when he was in the vet, I was always glad when we had an evening out in the Lincoln.
"No," said Eric. He was instantly brooding and emanating worry. I waited for him to elaborate. I waited some more.
"All right,"
I said, trying hard to regain my sense of pleasure in being out on a date with a gorgeous man.
"Okie dokie, have it your way.
But I think the sex will be a few degrees less spectacular if I'm worried about you and Pam." That bit of levity earned me a dark look.
"I know that Pam wants to make another vampire," I said. "I understand there's a time element involved."
"Emmanuel shouldn't have talked,"
Eric said.
It was nice to have someone actually share information with me, information directly pertaining to people I care about.
Did I have to draw a picture?
"Sookie, Victor has said I can't give permission for Pam to make a child."
Eric's jaw snapped shut like a steel trap.
"Oh. Kings have control over reproduction, I guess?"
I said cautiously.
"Yes, absolute control. But you understand that Pam is giving me hell about this, and so is Victor."
"Victor isn't a king, really, is he? Maybe if you went directly to Felipe."
"Every time I bypass Victor, he finds a way to punish me."
There was no point in talking about it. Eric was being pulled in two different directions as it was. So on the way to Victor's club, which Eric said was called Vampire's Kiss, we talked about the visit of the antique dealers the next day. There were lots of things I would have liked to discuss, but in view of Eric's overwhelmingly difficult position, I didn't want to bring up my own problems. Plus, I still had the feeling that I didn't know everything there was to know about Eric's situation.
"Eric,"
I said, and knew I was speaking too abruptly and with too much intensity.
"You don't tell me everything about your business, am I right?"
"You're right,"
he said, without missing a beat.
"But that's for many reasons, Sookie. Most important is that some of it you could only worry about, and the rest of it might put you in danger. Knowledge isn't always power."
I pressed my lips together and refused to look at him. Childish, I know, but I didn't completely believe him. After a moment of silence, he added,
"There's also the fact that I'm not used to sharing my daily concerns with a human, and it's hard to break the habit after 1,000 years.
"Right. And none of those secrets involved my future."
"Right."
Evidently, Eric read my stony self-possession as grudging acceptance, because he decided our tense moment was over.
"But you tell me everything, my lover, don't you?"
he asked teasingly. I glared at him and didn't answer. That wasn't what Eric had expected.
"You don't?"
he asked, and I couldn't figure out everything that was in his voice. Disappointment, concern, a touch of anger, and a dash of excitement. That was a lot to pack into a couple of words, but I swear it was all there.
"That's an unexpected twist,"
he murmured.
"And yet we say we love each other."
"We say we do," I agreed. "And I do love you. But I'm beginning to see that being in love doesn't mean sharing as much as I thought we would."
He had nothing to say to that. We passed Vic's redneck roadhouse on the way to the new dance club, and even from the interstate, I could see that the parking lot was packed.
"Crap," I said. "There sits all of Merlot's business. What do they have that we haven't got?"
"Entertainment? The novelty of being the new place? Waitresses in hot pants and halter tops?"
Eric began.
"Oh, stop,"
I said, disgusted.
Well, with the trouble about Sam being a shapeshifter and all the other stuff, I don't know how much longer Merlot's can hold out.
There was a surge of pleasure from Eric.
Oh, then you would have no job,
he said with faux sympathy.
You could work for me at Fangtasia.
No, thank you, I said it immediately. I would hate to see the Fangbangers come in night after night, always wanting what they shouldn't have. It's just sad and bad. Eric glanced over at me, not at all happy with my quick response.
That's how I make my money, Sookie, on the perverse dreams and fantasies of humans. Most of those humans are tourists who visit Fangtasia once or twice and then go back to Minden or Emerson and tell their neighbors about their walk on the wild side. Or they're people from the Air Force Base who like to show how tough they are by drinking at a vampire bar.
I understand that. And I know if Fangbangers don't come to Fangtasia, they'll go somewhere else they can hang around with vampires. But I don't think I'd like the ambiance on a day-to-day basis. I was kind of proud of myself for working in ambiance.
What would you do then, if Merlot's closed?
That was a good question, and one I was going to have to consider seriously. I said, I'd try to get another waitressing job, maybe at the Crawdad Diner. The tips wouldn't be as good as at a bar, but the aggravation would be less. And maybe I'd try to take some online classes and get some kind of degree. That would be nice, to have more education. There was a moment's silence.
You didn't mention contacting your great-grandfather, Eric said. He could make sure you never wanted for anything.
I'm not sure I could, I said, surprised. Contact him, that is. I guess Claude would know how. In fact, I'm sure he would. But Niall made it pretty clear he thought staying in touch wouldn't be a good idea. It was my turn to think for a second.
Eric, do you think Claude has an ulterior motive for coming to live with me?
Of course he does. Dermot too,
Eric said, without missing a beat.
I only wonder that you need to ask.
Not for the first time, I felt inadequate for the task of coping with my life. I fought a wave of self-pity, of bitterness, while I forced myself to examine Eric's words. I'd suspected as much, of course, and that was why I'd asked Sam if people really changed. Claude had always been the master of selfishness, the duke of disinterest. Why would he change? Oh, sure, he missed being around other fairies, especially now that his sisters were dead. But why would he come live with someone who had as little fairy blood as I did, especially when I'd been indirectly responsible for Claudine's death, unless he had something else on his mind? Dermot's motivation was just as opaque. It would be easy to assume Dermot's character was like Jason's because they look so much alike, but I'd learned from bitter experience what happened when I made assumptions. Dermot had been under a spell for a long time, a spell that had rendered him crazed. But even through the mental haze of the magic worked on him, Dermot had tried to do the right thing. At least, that was what he told me, and I had little evidence that that was true. I was still brooding over my gullibility when we took an exit ramp in the middle of nowhere. You could see the shine of the lights of Vampire's Kiss, which, of course, was the point.
Aren't you afraid that people who would have driven on into Shreveport to go to Fangtasia are just going to pull off when they see this club? I said.
Yes.
I'd asked a dumb question, so I gave him some slack for being short with me. Eric must have been brooding over his financial downturn ever since Victor had bought the building. But I wasn't prepared to give Eric any more free passes. We were a couple, and he should either share his life completely with me or let me worry about my own concerns. It wasn't easy being yoked to Eric.